Good morning, everyone. I just want to comment on Kirsten's amazing thoughts. One of the things that I like to mention when I talk to audiences these days is that we need to keep in mind that we are all mentoring and we are all being mentored, that everything we do with other people, it's an act of mentoring, it's an act of being mentored. And so to keep these ideas of diversity front of mind means to bring them into the way we mentor or are mentored by other people. All right. I'm here today in my capacity as a futurist. That's a very woolly term. What I want to do is demystify that term a little bit. This is not a futurist. This is a psychic. You go to them if you want to find out what the lotto numbers are going to be, if you want to find out who's going to win the Melbourne Cup. This is not what I do. What I do is something much closer to what a climatologist does. I don't tell you what's going to happen tomorrow, but I do tell you what the climate's going to be like if you're operating in a business environment in 5 or 10 years. Because we look at the trends, we make intelligent observations of where those trends are going, and you'll see this through the talk, we look for the seeds of the future in the present. All right, so that's what futurists do. Now, I've been asked to speak about automation, humanity, and I'm going to start that off, believe it or not, by talking about what's going on underwater. As all of you know, every municipal water system has hundreds of kilometers of drains and channels and pipes, and they all have to be maintained. It's all a lot of work because it involves significant manpower. Often you have to put someone into scuba gear and get them down in an area where it's quite dangerous to get them to look and see if your system is in good working order. So it's difficult, it's dangerous, it's expensive. What if there were a better way? What if instead of sending a diver down to take a look at something to find out whether it was in good nick, what if you could send a robot down to perform that inspection? Now, the idea is not entirely new. They've been doing similar things to this on drilling rigs for, say, 10 years or so. But what we're seeing now is that the robotics revolution has been a slow burn. It's been what we would like to call a 20-year overnight success story. The sensing technologies on robots have progressively been getting better and cheaper so that robots can be more aware of the world around them. The control systems inside of them, the brains and the software, they have grown by leaps and bounds over the last couple of years. And they're now both designable and they're manufacturable at scale, so that means the prices have dropped. And the technology is now getting to be so well understood that a community of enthusiasts was able to come together 6 years ago to create something called the Open Source Remotely Operated Vehicle, or Open ROV. There it is. Now, I'm not sure if you folks have heard the words open source before. It's a term that came in from the technology community. What it really means is that the community behind the project collaboratively did the work to create the project. And it means that that work can be taken by anyone else to adapt, to improve, to change in any way that they might feel is appropriate. Now, you may not have heard of open source, but open source has changed the world because everyone here who's using a smartphone, and that is probably almost everyone in this room, everyone here is using an open source operating system. If you're using an Android phone, there's an open source operating system called Linux running on your smartphone. If you're using an iOS device, there's an open source operating system called Darwin running on it. So open source literally powers the entire world these days. Now, it wasn't always like that. If you go back 20 years or so, you see very little open source software. There weren't really any cheap submersibles because there wasn't any way to make them happen. All of that has changed. And what we can do is we actually get a look into where things are going in the 21st century by taking a look at how that changed. Now, it's very likely that the first piece of open source software that you used without knowing it was the World Wide Web. We do not think about the web as a piece of software, but trust me, it is. It's the software that's connecting all of these computers all over the world together and to a web browser. It's the connective tissue for the modern world. And the reason that we're using the web and not something else that might be web-like is because the fellow who invented the web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, talked his bosses into making it freely available, into giving it away. And you can see at the bottom of the page, this is, by the way, that's the very first web page, just so you know. And in there, there's an open invitation, grab our software and use it. And that meant that universities and libraries and museums could set up their own websites without having to pay fees. It meant that businesses could have a go. Just, they didn't need to have a business plan. They didn't need to have an ROI. They could just try the web to see if it would solve a problem. The great thing about the web is that it connects people. So someone might try something over here, and someone else would see it, and they would copy it, and they would change it, or they would improve it, or they would build their own thing on top of it. And then someone else would see that, and they would copy it, and change it, and improve it, and build on top of that, and on, and on, and on. And the web built itself out of nothing in probably about 5 years' time, because everyone who was on the web was sharing what they were doing. And everyone was looking at what everyone else was doing, and they were learning from what everyone else was doing. And we're still learning from one another. Now, the early days of the web, those of you who are young enough to, old enough to remember, were a bit charming. They were a bit anarchic. They were not pretty by modern standards. It's something that we had to do a fair bit of playing with to get it right, to get it where it felt good. The first sense of how right we could get the web happened in 2001. When a fellow named Jimmy Wales took his struggling four-pay encyclopedia and decided to open it up. He turned his encyclopedia into an open source project that not only could anyone use for free, but anyone could add to for free. Wikipedia started off as a toy. Then it became a joke. Then it became a threat to Encyclopedia Britannica, the reference text in the English language, and then it just basically completely crushed it. And it did all of that in under a decade. And it did that despite the fact that Britannica was written by experts. The article on relativity in the Encyclopedia Britannica was written by Albert Einstein. So you have incredible experts working in an expert way in Encyclopedia Britannica. Wikipedia doesn't have experts. It's written by us. It's written by punters. It has millions of contributors. Everyone is sharing what they know, correcting the things that people have shared, learning from one another, and improving one another's work. But that, just that is enough. That is enough to put a comprehensive knowledge resource into the hands of everyone who has a smartphone. So Wikipedia is kind of our penny drop moment in the modern era, because we realize that sharing what we know makes all of us smarter. It also helps make all of us dumber, but we'll come to that a little further along. Broadly, though, we're all less stupid than we were a few years ago, theoretically at least. Theoretically, when we take advantage of the enormous resources of knowledge and expertise that are now on offer. And it's that kind of capacity building that leads to the open ROV. That's the second generation model, by the way, which is cheaper and designed to be even more accessible to hobbyists. And that's one of countless open source projects created by people who were learning and sharing with one another and were better at it because they were sharing with one another. And each project out there that's open source tends to leverage the capacities of everyone involved and tends to amplify those capacities. People who are involved in open source projects get better skills that they take to everything else that they do. And that means that you can create a submersible robot basically from the whole cloth, even though you have no one on your team who's designed one before. But of course, that's not the whole story. A submersible is going to need an operator. It's going to need someone driving it at the end of the tether, telling the submersible what to do next. That used to be the case. There's been a huge side effect in the change in the way we learn, because it's had an overflow, because it's also changed the way that we teach machines. You've been hearing a lot lately about artificial intelligence, maybe about machine learning. It's hit an inflection point. I want to talk about what that inflection point really looks like. So that's KG. KG over there in the corner, he's the best human player of the board game Go, and you can see the board game there, Chinese board game, 2,500 years old. It's not like chess. With chess, you can get a computer to simply outthink a human being. You cannot outthink with Go, because the number of possible moves on a Go board are 10 trillion, 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 trillion. And ain't no computer fast enough to do all of that. You have to learn how to play Go. So these researchers in the UK taught a computer how to play Go from basic principles, and what they did was they allowed the computer to learn from every move it made and learn from all of the mistakes it made, and then they gave it really mediocre humans to play, and it lost to the humans over and over and over again, but every time it lost, it got a little bit better, and then finally it was able to beat mediocre human players, and they said, okay, we'll up it and we'll give it a slightly better range of human players, and it lost and it lost, but it learned and it learned and it learned, and it kept learning, and within about 2 years, AlphaGo, which was the name of this computer program, could beat a mid-range Go player, which was still better than anything that had ever happened before that. Then they upped the pressure even more, because they then got AlphaGo to start playing both really good human players and to start to play itself. So now it's playing hundreds of games against humans and thousands of games against itself. It's making more mistakes. It's learning even more. And then, just a year ago, there was a contest between KG and AlphaGo. AlphaGo wiped the deck 5 games out of 5. And KG in the press conference afterwards said it was like playing a god. Well, you know how they grew that god? By making millions and millions and millions of mistakes. And this is the key to understanding artificial intelligence. There is no magic there. What we've done is we've taught computers how to learn from their mistakes. Computers can be very focused, so they can be very focused on learning from those mistakes. So that's the AI revolution in a nutshell. And so it was that, say, 2 years ago, I guess, at Sydney University, I mentor in a program called Incubate, which is for young startups. I met the folks who do a company called Abyss Solutions. Now, originally, they were making a robot that they thought plumbers would be using to inspect piping in buildings. But as they worked through their design, they realized they had come onto something that was a lot bigger. They could use the open ROV submersible robot, and they could create a robot that could inspect drainage systems, and it could do it remotely, and it could do it safely. But of course, unlike the systems, and that's it right there, unlike the systems that exist today, which require a human operator watching all of the footage that the drone is generating as it's going through the water system to see if there's any problems in the piping, Abyss Solutions is using artificial intelligence. So the data comes in, all of this video footage, and the computer looks at it and says, yeah, this is not interesting, this is not, oh, that's interesting. And then it passes that along to a human to look at. So all of the boring bits are being taken out. The human is getting to focus on the most interesting bits of the tour. And most of that software was built on top of other open source software that Abyss Solutions had access to. So they're building what they're doing with machine learning on top of sharing. And it turns out this is a really good way to do it. When you actually can have a submersible that can handle most of the work itself but hand the difficult bits off to the human, turns out that's a really good, really cost-effective, and really smart way to work. And so Abyss has grown from 4 people when I was working with them 2 years ago. They have 20 people now, and they have clients all over the world, including here. You see them servicing the Hoover Dam. Machines are doing what they do best. Humans are doing what they do best. And it turns out that the sum of the parts is greater than either. Because what happens is when you put the two together, you can do the job better, you can do the job faster, you can do the job safer, and you can do the job cheaper. Because we're working together. And we have been hearing far too much about how the machines are going to put us all out of work, how they're going to run us into unemployment. We have been hearing far too little about how this new generation of machines is actually being used to amplify our capacities, allowing us to focus on the interesting bits, allowing us to make the most of our gifts. This is what the middle of the 21st century looks like. It's not an either-or, where it's either the machines or the humans in a Terminator landscape. It's a multiplicity where we are finding lots and lots of ways to make the human-machine combination work for us. That sounds wonderful, and it is wonderful. But these innovations also present some really unexpected dilemmas that I want to cover now. We have sensors for practically everything. And these, of course, are water sensors. We're measuring almost everything everywhere. And, of course, within the next decade, we're going to have water meters everywhere. That's going to be part of the transition that we see. That's going to be a fantastic cost savings unless, as with this poor fellow, you're a water meter reader. He's going to need a new job. But you're going to have this enormous electronic flow of information coming in. Data is from millions of residences, from millions of offices. That is going to prove invaluable, not just for billing, but for planning, for detecting leaks, all sorts of things that you'll be able to see in the data. And the water utilities will be buying software that will be able to do analytics on this data. They will analyze every data stream in detail, and this is where the dilemma lies. Because with very little effort, it should be really easy to profile someone fairly precisely from their water usage. You'll be able to tell when someone wakes up in the morning, when they shower, when they make their coffee, when they prepare or they're cleaning up from a meal, when they go to sleep. All of that will be revealed in that data stream. It will be as if they shouted it from the rooftops. And of course, they haven't. And if people thought you could see their comings and goings and the livings of their lives from their water usage, they would probably feel a little uncomfortable about that. I want you to consider how Facebook is doing now after a couple of scandals about how private data suddenly became very public data. And you are going to be collecting really detailed data on all of your customers. You will understand their habits. You will understand their weaknesses. You'll be able to see them as clearly as if you had cameras in their homes. And you're going to have some serious responsibilities about how you use that data. Can you sell the data? Can you use that data to sell new services to your customers? Can you pass along suspicious behavior to law enforcement? And, as we're familiar with from last week, what happens when that data gets stolen or lost? A connected world is a smart world, but a connected world is also where data attacks have huge consequences. And it's not just businesses that get hacked into. Detailed personal data is useful for stalkers, it's useful for thieves, it's useful for arsonists. People who know where you are and what you're doing can use that information against you, and you will have that data. That part is inevitable. And your machines, they're going to be busy digesting it to give you better insights about your customers. so you can have better products for them and better product planning for yourself. But never forget that you have a duty of care. And I don't mean simply the new laws about data breaches, although those are important. You have an ethical responsibility to be transparent about how you collect data, how you use that data, and how you put that data to work for others. Only when you're transparent can your customers monitor your behavior with their data. And if you don't provide transparency, be sure that the government will force you to, because someone will misuse that data and it will become a crisis and you will be forced to do the right thing. And your customers will feel a little violated, which, if you think about it, is how a lot of people feel about the banks right now. So transparency isn't just a good idea when it comes to data. Transparency is safety. Transparency is surety. Transparency is the way we need to work whenever we bring together human and machine intelligence. If we're not careful, we will get that wrong, and we will forget that the machines are simply doing what we told them to do, learning what we asked them to learn, and sharing all of that because that's what we told them to do. And we are going to be faced with ethical dilemmas that will be amplified because we used these machines. This is the real human face of automation. It isn't about someone being put out of a job. It's a machine that is profiling someone with such a degree of accuracy, just based on their water usage, that you can tell pretty much everything else about how they live their lives. Now, no one is going to ask you to scrap the sensors. No one is going to ask you to avoid automation or ignore the data, because the data itself is really precious. It's really important. But that data has tremendous potential to both help and to harm unless it is framed around transparency. Now, here's the thing. It's really easy to build machine learning systems, artificial intelligence that spots outliers, classifies, oh, there's the troublemaker, someone is using too much water or using it in the wrong way, deals with them very inflexibly. Think about what's going on with Centrelink right now and the robodebts. Machines are super good at being inflexible. And what happens is we tend to build all of our biases into our machines when we're designing them. We decide what data we want to collect. We decide why it's important. We decide how much it matters and to whom it matters. And all of that is very carefully coded into the entire design of the systems, the sensors we use to collect the data, the algorithms we're using to process the data, the way we share that data. If we want to look for a certain kind of behavior, chances are we'll find it because we've designed the entire system to amplify that information. And that's actually a bit of a trap, because really what we're seeing is a bit of a ghost. It's reflecting our own paranoia and our own concerns back at us. It's not showing us what's really there. This is what I mean when I say that we have the capacity now not just to amplify our knowledge, but to amplify our stupidity and our ignorance. This is a problem, believe it or not, that Facebook has gotten into, because Facebook profiles you so closely when you're using that app, they can basically monitor your emotional state and they will change the content of your newsfeed to keep you on Facebook while you're using it. Bit creepy. The hardest thing to do in a data-rich age is to simply let the data speak for itself. We always want to see what we're looking for in the data. We always want to. That's our problem. We want to put our voice into something that's trying to speak for itself. And that's not a new problem. Science has been confronting this from the beginning. This is why they have peer review. This is why you let other people who don't have your vested interests look at your data. So, as we build these systems, as the data is coming in from these sensors, we are going to need to get very good at something we're not good at right now, listening. Right now, everyone wants to be a little bit shouty, and we kind of think that the shoutiest voice is the one that's worth listening to. But there's a problem with that, because as soon as we start listening to the loudest voice, rather than the truthful voice, we start making decisions based on the things we can hear and not on the things that are true. And that's why sharing can make us dumber. If we focus on the wrong things, if we confirm what we want to believe rather than looking for the truth. But it's possible that we can actually get the machines to remind us that we need to look further afield for the truth. If you have a smartwatch, you know it might tap every 20 minutes to make sure that you get up and walk around. You can imagine an artificial intelligence tapping you every once in a while to get you to question your assumptions. We'll resent that because we don't like being told we're not right. But we're going to need that in the 21st century as we've never needed it before. The future is not clear sailing. It is not some harmonious marriage of human and machine possibilities. Like all relationships, it's going to have good sides and bad sides. It's going to have strengths. It's going to have weaknesses. Being realistic is the best place to start with those relationships because it means that we are going to build in the sorts of safeguards that can keep this relationship on firm ground as we both work out the best and worst qualities in one another. We are going to need to work on our listening, just as you do in relationships. We're going to need to work on our sensitivities, just as you do in relationships. And we're going to have to be willing to listen to and adapt to the other's needs, just as we do in relationships. And we need to do this because none of this is happening in a vacuum. The transformations that are happening in water, the things that are going on with Abyss Solutions, those are happening in every other industry everywhere. The voices are multiplying, and they all have something important to say. One of the best bits of mentoring that I've received in 25 years came from a quiet bloke who advised me, say little, listen much. The future belongs to those who can listen. To the human voices, to the data, to the algorithms of the machines. Listen closely, share, and learn. Thank you.